Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige movie. This time, we're going to talk about the movie Castaway. This is the 20th anniversary. Can't believe it. 20th anniversary of the movie Castaway, starring Tom Hanks, where a ambitious FedEx employee gets marooned on a desert island in the South Pacific. It was directed by Robert Zemeckis. We all know Robert Zemeckis, right? Mr. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Mr. Back to the Future, Mr. Romancing the Stone, Mr. Forrest Gump. You know, that's the other big Oscar collaboration that he had with Tom Hanks. Screenplay by William Broyles Jr., who was one of the writers on China Beach. Also wrote Apollo 13, Entrapment, Planet of the Apes, The Polar Express, and was one of the writers of Saving Private Ryan. It starred Tom Hanks, Helen Hunt, and a little bit of Nick Searcy. I can't remember how to pronounce this game. It's or this guy's name. It's Art, Raylan Givens' boss from Justified.
Yep.
And that's it. It's 99% Tom Hanks, all by his lonesome, sharing a screen with the volleyball. Jim, I don't know how long it's been since you've seen this movie. I'm pretty sure you've seen it before. What was it like seeing it again? What did you think of it? Has time improved your recollection or estimation of this film or what?
Time hasn't improved it, but that's not to say that I don't enjoy it. Like, it's kind of an amazing movie. But I thought that when I first saw it. So I've seen it a couple times, few times. I don't know. This is probably third, fourth time I've seen it. And yeah, it absolutely holds up. There's nothing to really date this movie too much. So, like, you know, we still have planes, islands still exist, people still exist. So all this stuff, it's like, oh, if he had a cell phone, this movie would be ruined. No, there, you know, no reception on this island. So right. I don't know. It really holds up 20 years later, I think.
Yeah. I mean, pagers being the state of the art technology was a little bit of a what the hell, but
sure.
Yeah. No, I thought so too. I remember this film being a really absorbing film. You know, I wouldn't believe that there's so little talking in 2/3 of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it doesn't surprise me because in the last few years, I found it really relaxing and rewarding to watch channels where guys essentially do stuff like this. I'm thinking of the guy in Australia, Primitive Technology. He doesn't even talk during his videos. He just sits and, you know, makes mud bricks and huts and bows and arrows and all kinds of stuff. This guy lately does the same thing, only with a little bit more modern gear. Joe Robin it up in Canada. It's just, I don't know, something about just watching people make fire and do things in a quiet, kind of purposeful way is relaxing. And this, in an actual survival situation, is even inherently more so. So it taps into that, just kind of like the voyeurism of just watching people do these ancient things and rediscover these ways of living. And I think it also works as kind of like a nice little philosophical piece about, like,
yeah,
what is important about life and what are the things that keep us going in dark times. So the movie's 2.5 hours long. It flies by. It felt like about half
for sure.
That.
I'm shocked that you find this movie in any way relaxing. This movie is beyond stressful for me.
Really?
Yeah. I watched this movie and I'm Tom Hanks at the beginning of the island adventure. I'm Tom Hanks trying to make a fire and failing. I'm watching this thing just stressed out of my mind, like this life or death situation, and he's ill-equipped to deal with it, both, you know, from the stuff he has on hand, but also his skills are just not there. This is a far cry from dudes with their GoPros posting like must have internet access, right, to post this shit.
Sure.
About, like,
yeah,
with
yeah,
them
yeah.
in the wilderness. Doing this stuff for fun. Like, this is the exact opposite of that for me.
I saw that Australian dude make a silicon chip. It was crazy. I wouldn't believe it's possible. He had a mud microscope. I don't know how it happened.
But probably ordered it off Amazon and they delivered it to him.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess I I found myself getting really stressed out about the plane crash and, you know, him getting up to walk around and not taking. I mean, there's some interesting observations about how he values time even in those moments. Hmm. But, like, once the immediate, like, disaster is over and he washed up on the island, I guess I did. Yeah, I found it, like, very comforting and calming. I guess the other thing is because I knew he gets, you know, I knew he gets off of the island. And
Yeah.
I was also wondering, that's the thing I was curious about is like, because I remember being very confused about how I felt about his arrival and how that was handled in the film when I was a much younger man. Hmm. And now I think like, well, that's just because that's a really tough situation for everybody involved. And I feel for everybody.
You're talking about his arrival home after the ordeal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Holy hell. That is a scenario that is filled with regret, no matter which way it goes.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, what do you, how do we want to start here? I guess maybe we should tell people if you haven't seen it, because this is an older film. It's 20 years old at mm-hmm. this point. Jesus, we're older people. Tom Hanks is a some kind of Federal Express troubleshooter, FedEx troubleshooter.
He's a fixer.
He's a fixer, yeah. If someone's murdering a clock somewhere, he's going to go find it. Mm-hmm. And in his jetting around the world, he gets he's on a cargo plane because that's what you used to be able to do before 9/11 and FedEx. You could just book a cargo plane and go places. And I imagine a jet-setting executive like Tom Hanks has spent a lot of time in these. Gets in a South Pacific storms, blown off course, gets the loss treatment. He's the sole survivor of this wreck. He washes up on a deserted island. And he spends a long, long time there. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's him just trying to survive on the island and getting off it is the rest of the story. And it's pretty good. Where do we want to begin in our deep analysis of the film? I guess I was curious when you said you found the entire film stressful. Like, really? I guess it's maybe designed to be like that, and there's, like, little moments of triumph when he, like, first gets the coconut open with the rock, when he makes fire, obviously. That's a big, like, one of the few lighthearted scenes in the film.
Yeah.
But maybe it's a good place to start with Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. Because he is one of the few, I think, actors that had the exact tool set. He's got the physical comedy. He's got the kind of the wry observation. He's famously an everyman, so it's easy to project yourself in this situation. And he's got serious dramatic chops that he can really sell the incredible experiences he goes through in the end of the film. He's the perfect actor for this film.
Yeah, and it's... You know, you think of movies getting sort of cast after the concept has been developed and they have a screenplay and everything. But this kind of seemed to be spearheaded by Hanks in a large part. Like, I know he kind of had this idea of like exploring hope and hopelessness, essentially, and had this idea about like the island thing. And he took it to the writer and they put together a script for it. And that's kind of the opposite way that I think stuff usually gets made. But Tom Hanks is Hollywood as fuck, right? Like,
yeah,
he's a big known quantity in Hollywood, not just for
he's got
on screen but off screen stuff too. So
he's got what they call juice. He's got some juice that he can squirt around and make things happen.
Yeah. So it seems to have been the genesis was just he has this idea about like exploring those themes and the deserted island was the way to go.
The screenwriter had like the screenwriter and Zemeckis and had like 2/3 of the film, essentially all the island stuff figured out. But they didn't have like a framing device. Like, you know, why would this guy be here? What would this? And Tom Hanks is the guy who I guess he said he was reading something on a flight about the number of packages to go across the Pacific Ocean in a single day and like all these big jumbo jets full of this packages crisscrossing the Pacific. And, you know, he caught wind of this and it's kind of like that kind of, you know, that was the thing, the secret sauce that they needed to get the thing underway.
And I assumed that there was a lot of involvement from FedEx in this movie. Like,
me
FedEx
too.
Comes to them and said, hey, Bobby Z, we got this great idea for a movie. it revolves around our planes and our packages, and the whole storyline is just going to be following this one package from FedEx that finally gets delivered. Rain, snow, sleet, or desert island. Well, deserted island. But no, apparently FedEx didn't have much involvement other than letting them shoot in their facilities. Like you said, sure. Tom Hanks was more of the inspiration here to bring in FedEx. So that really surprised me. And I assumed Wilson had a lot to do with it, but I guess not. I guess that was like the writer stranded himself. I don't know what this means in this context, but stranded himself on a beach in California somewhere for a week without food or water. And one of the things that washed up during this experience, he says, is this volleyball or a volleyball. And so that gave him the idea to make this a character in the film.
Yeah, it's I'd say a pretty brilliant conceit. I guess there's some versions of the script that had essentially bad Hanks, good Hanks, kind of like a Smeagol and Gollum kind of separation that, you know, when they have internal conversations. And like that just reads more bonkers crazy. It's already bonkers crazy, but like you can kind of tell that Tom Hanks, his character, Chuck, is just kind of doing this as a bit, or just like he recognizes that this isn't like normal behavior, but what is normal on a desert island? That one level of remove, it first of all adds a lot of comedy to it.
Yeah.
Because you can actually physically have a fight with a ball. You could throw it and fling it and you can make up with it later.
Sure.
But I don't know. I wonder how, to what level the filmmakers knew that they had a hit there with Wilson, because that kind of really captured the public's attention. To this day, you can go on the Wilson Company's website and order for $19.99 a Wilson edition volleyball. Like it was, wow. I mean, Wilson was on commercials. Yeah. You know, that it really penetrated the consciousness. It became like a co-star. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it becomes the audience's window into his what's going on in his mind too, which I think is super important. Yeah, you could do the split of the personalities, but that's been done to death, and B, that's a bit of like you said, it makes him too crazy, but it also feels cheesy in a way. I don't know, maybe because it's been done so often. This felt somehow new and fresh, but gave you that window you really needed into what he's thinking at any given moment and his just his mental state.
Yeah, and I would love to know how many designs it went through before they kind of came up with this, because I think there is like if it would have been too crude and like less kind of cute and approachable, it wouldn't have worked. And if it had been, you know, if he'd had like drawn on it like he was trying to do the Helen Hunt cave paintings, it would have been weird.
Ugh.
But there's something just in that particular design. And even when like Wilson, like when they do the 4-year flash forward, Wilson's like more feral. You know, he's obviously popped, but now he's stuffed with coconut and it's this shock of hair coming out. Like it just the design ages with it. And I don't know, it's something really iconic. In fact, I wonder if they could charge like $39.99 for a Farrell Wilson, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
The late stage Wilson. Yeah. Maybe the idea is you're supposed to take him on an adventure and he's supposed to get Farrell with you.
Okay. Sure. I'm not staying on any islands for 5 years, but fine.
This was a big commitment. Like, you know, you talk about this kind of stuff with who's the Batman guy?
Christian Bale.
He does this a lot. He bulks up to play Batman. He slims down to play the machinist. He gains 75 pounds in American Hustle. Like, he's always going up and down. This is one of the first ones that I remember reading about. Tom Hanks gained 50 pounds to pack on weight for the project. They filmed all the movie up until the 4 year later jump scene, and then they took a full year off so that Tom Hanks could grow out his hair, grow out his beard into his crazy wilderness survivor guy look, and just get emaciated to lose a lot of weight. He's naturally kind of a thin guy, and they just really went all in on that. In fact, this because of this production stretched so long that Robert Zemeckis took his film crew and made a whole other movie, What Lies Beneath, in the hiatus of this movie, which I thought was kind of an incredible detail. I can't imagine, like, you know, spending a year of your life Well, probably 2 years total. Filming, fasting, getting fat, filming, fasting, getting skinny, going back and filming. I guess the film shut down for like 2 or 3 months for the final scenes of him and, you know, getting back to the mainland because he was already tan and he had all that hair. So
yeah,
I thought that was cool. And it's, again, something I'd never heard of anyone doing before the Castaway business.
Yeah, I can't help but think you talked about the influence of Wilson and then, you know, this transformation that Hanks does. I can't help but think of Always Sunny when I think of this movie.
Mac
does those transformations too, right? Like he bulks up, he then gains
for no reason either. It's just right. Yeah,
it's not like he gets stranded on an island or anything. No,
there's no storytelling. He's just doing it, I guess.
So he does that, and then they've got the Rum Ham episode, which obviously is inspired by heavily inspired by Wilson.
Of course it is. Rum Ham.
Yeah.
Rum Ham.
It's fantastic. And yeah, those two things are inextricably linked in my mind.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
I think it's funny that, like, it's a testament to how well the Wilson concept works that when he goes flying away and Tom Hanks, which is giving a really broad grief performance, doesn't... I mean, I saw it with an audience, I think, once or twice. There was no one laughing, you know, because it's an inherently silly scene. It could be parody. You know, it's hilarious when Danny DeVito is bemoaning the fate of Rumham.
Right.
But, you know, this is this guy losing his soul's form of emotional support for 4 years. It's a real friend to him.
Yeah. Yeah, those links back to civilization and society and hope, really, is what it is, are super important for the movie. And Wilson is the sort of a personification of that in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the other hope signifier, which is that package with the angel wings. So, yeah, right. Every time you see those two things, you're thinking, okay, what are they going to do with this? Because, and there's a couple things like that. When Wilson floats away, obviously that's like his hope floating away, right? And the angel wings rip off his raft, and that's the hope flying away. Like, and then he's essentially, from there on out, he's a dead man.
Yeah.
It just happens to float by a tanker and he's picked up. But yeah, they do a few things like that.
Yeah, and I thought there was man, this movie is so efficient because that loss of hope is gradual. He loses Wilson, then he loses the sail, then he loses Wilson, and then the next scene after he gets done spending all day grieving, you see him like just giving his paddles to the sea. Like that's him. That is him finally giving up. But
they do it with the flashlight too earlier on when he's in the cave and he falls asleep with the flashlight on and it winks out eventually.
Yeah. Pisses away a resource. It's interesting because like they set that up, the fact that like this island's not that far from a shipping lane, because right in the very first movie you see a boat go by. So the idea is not like he has to go back to the mainland or another island. He just has to get out there. And if you're in a major shipping lane, there'll be boats. And so it's like, I remember thinking of how coincidental it was that he was able to be found in the right time, the right place, all that kind of stuff. But when I was watching it, I'm like, you know what? This movie's doing some pretty smart stuff to like answer a lot of those questions.
Yeah. Including with character development. Because, you know a thing or two about shipping lanes as a 40-plus-year-old man, right? Like, might not have known as a 20-plus-year-old man.
Sure.
So now you see a little bit more into that. But with the character of Chuck, they do some really smart things. You know, he doesn't have the skills like a Boy Scout to build a fire or create, you know, a hut or anything like that. But what he does have is these sailor skills. Because if you look early on in the movie, They don't even have a conversation about it, nothing. It's just sort of decoration in his house that they feature momentarily, mm-hmm. where he has awards for sailing, right? He's got nautical clocks or compasses maybe as decorations in his house. Like, he's an accomplished mm-hmm. sailor. And so later on when the port-a-potty sail comes in and he's like calculating all of these things, like with the wind and the seasons and all of that, you go, okay, this is a guy who might actually be able to do that. Because me stuck on that island? No way. Absolutely not. I don't know anything about the seasonal wind patterns.
Yeah, no, I thought that was really, it's there. It's all show, not tell. So like if someone's smarty pants, like, oh, this is completely unbelievable. How could this guy? There's plausible answers in the setup. And I thought like, you know, it's a model of efficiency. They spend less than 15 minutes to set up this guy, that he's like this really wound tight, obsessed with time, which is going to be, you know, lavished with resources, short on time. He's going to be completely judo flopped on the other side of being starved of resources with nothing but time. The fact that he's got the tooth that's bad, they set up. The fact that he's got this relationship with his girlfriend. The fact that he's kind of like self-obsessed to the fact that like other people who probably are not as close to the Nick Searchy friend character know about his wife and he didn't know at all about it. She's a research scientist, Helen Hunt. So, like, that kind of, like, gives you without, like, the movie, without having to let you know, the fact that she didn't finish her PhD dissertation or whatever. She never became doctor, like, a shorthand for her fucking experience that she went through in the 4 years.
Yeah.
Them frantically getting their schedule straight to shows, like, how, like, just book time. There's just all this stuff that they're doing to show a particular type of person that Chuck is. So then when you get to, they have to front load all of this, because there's no plausible way for this to come out other than like
no.
jokes with Wilson once you get to the island. So, you know, that's a dense first 15 minutes. And they are also making it like, you know, a pretty engaging FedEx troubleshooter heroic story too.
Yeah. And there's also stuff about, I don't know what to call her at the end, but Bettina, I think, is the character's name, who lives out on the ranch and is a steel worker.
Oh, the angel lady,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do some pretty efficient, almost too efficient stuff there, because it was only after sitting down and thinking about it for a second that I realized what they were doing with this package with the wings on it, coming mm-hmm. from Texas over to Moscow, where it's delivered to this guy who opens the door and takes the package and says, oh, it's for my wife or whatever. That's the guy. And if you look at the sign at the ranch, at the beginning it says Dick and Bettina. At the end, the Dick part is gone and it just says Bettina.
Oh, shit. I didn't even realize that.
So they've broken up in those 5 years, and that's why, because he's cheating on her with some Russian woman.
Russian floozy, yeah.
Yeah. Right? So they're really efficient in setting that stuff up, too. And she's not really a character, per se, but...
Yeah, no.
She represents a potential future for this guy who's had a harrowing experience and lost the love of his life.
An epic rebound, if nothing else.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
But, I mean, there's a bunch of other stuff, too, because, like, you know, he essentially proposes to her. So, like, they do all these tricks to just set up the maximum amount of psychological debt and damage that this thing could do. And also give him, like, plausible stakes for, like, why, you know, he would give up hope and then rekindle hope. Because that's, like, the reading between the lines. Well, it's not even reading between the lines. The movie comes out and says it in the speech that he gives. To his friend, but like at the 3 year mark, he tries to kill himself because he realizes that like even if I get off this island at this point, my life is going to be gone. There's no way that she's going to leave, wait for me. Like this has changed. Like I've gotten control over nothing but in the manner in which I die. And yeah, and like I think there's interesting little signposts for like all the little pieces of him that he gives away. For example, when he breaks down and opens up the FedEx package, that was him giving up like model FedEx employee. Like he's no longer thinking, oh, this is going to be a hell of a story when I tell Moscow the next time. You know?
And I noticed like when he's collecting these packages, it's like, okay, the packages must be delivered, right? But then he sits down and he sorts them into piles, but probably by like airport code, right?
And I are both doing
former
FedEx
employees. We've done the sorts.
Yeah,
I worked
on
non-coms.
Sort right there on the beach. He's doing a package sort.
Yeah, and they get absurd. A package sort in the movie prior to this. So you, even if you're not a former FedEx employee, you know what he's doing there.
Right, like a disaster sort in the middle of Red Square.
Yeah,
but it's really ridiculous because that's a scene where he's desperate for water and there's a monsoon and he's using a viable way to collect water to protect packages from water. It's ridiculous, and then. Yeah. He gives up a little bit more of himself when he does the math and realizes, oh my God, they're looking for me over a size of twice the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. And then there's like just little bits else that he gives away. And then, you know, notably, it's really haunting when you get to 4 years later and you just see, I remember in the audience gasps when people saw the 4 year later and then, you know, what Tom Hanks had become. It was genuinely kind of shocking.
In some ways, it's inspiring, though, too, because, like, you look at him and they've just shown you the scenes of him flailing around in the water, throwing a spear so ineffectually. Like, this is straight out of a Tom Hanks comedy movie.
Right.
And then the introduction is him spearing this fish first try, no problem. And he's standing on this rock.
15 yards, nailing it.
Beard is waving in the wind. His hair is waving in the wind. He's thin. He's tanned. He's you know, a machine. He is built to do... Yeah. He's a survival machine.
Yeah, and there's no more joy in the accomplishment. There's no more, you know, thrill of the hunt. It's just a routine. And then, like, him, like, catatonically eating this fish raw. He's not even going to bother eating, you know, getting a fire going for it.
He's JSSing. He's just surviving somehow.
Just surviving
what
somehow.
It comes down to.
And then, like, and they do a lot, like, in these survival scenes of, like, portraying Tom Hanks as kind of like a 2001 monkey. And I guess some of these scenes were deliberate because 2001 is one of Tom Hanks' favorite movie. And they filmed, like, the porta potty, him looking at that as like, a monkey considering a monolith, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
poking at it with a stick.
And it also spawns the island's industrial age. I thought that was kind of like the monolith, you know, makes proto-humans use weapons and tools for the first time. This monolith got the whole island set up in production mode. Now he's got to make this thing and
ropes
he's burning
and
things
rafts.
Down. He's clear cutting forests and all this stuff. It's a really tight way to tell a story with all these like internal references to 2001. Him sitting there like, you know, figuring out how to like nap flint in real time and like banging a rock. Like I feel like I've seen YouTube videos of frustrated monkeys trying to get into stuff that looks just like that. Mm. I just thought it's really really great.
There is one moment that I am not sure I like, or that they could have played a little subtler. And that's shocking considering how subtle they are in most of this movie. Like there's a scene toward the end where, like, I noted what was happening when he gives his keys back to Helen Hunt before he takes off on this plane, because, you know, it's got this knife on it, right? And then at the end of the movie, that comes back, and she has kept the car, and she's giving him the car, and she hands him the keys. And while she's looking in the car or whatever, getting her stuff, he flips open that knife, just kind of looks at it, and, you know, gives this ironic, like, half eye roll thing that is so perfect in the moment. He doesn't have to say anything. You just know exactly what he's thinking. I feel like they should have also done that. And they did do it, but then they followed up. When he goes up to get the 30 feet of rope that is the noose that he did the suicide test with, they did not need to have a scene where he explains that to Wilson, in my opinion. I think I got absolutely everything I needed to know from him hauling that thing back up.
I think you're right, but that's only one half of that scene, because the other half is the fight. The rupture and then the makeup. And do you think that, I mean, it's an open question because I don't know. Like, do you think that they had fully sold Wilson as a character? Like, you know, I think like Wilson was essentially a joke until those several scenes of him, like, you know, having real conversations with Wilson.
Yeah, you're right.
But it's like, but what else would they fight about? And that's kind of like the good Tom, bad Tom kind of thing. Like I said, I don't think this movie's perfect.
And that's not a very egregious sin, in my opinion.
Right.
Like, okay, they over-explained one thing, big deal. You know, I might have tried to tighten it up there a slight bit and have them fight over something else.
I also wonder why it was so important for him to jump. Like, it seems like if you just wanted to die, you could just do a header off of that, you know. Like what was the really important thing about does he have afraid of heights? Like just this 3 or 4 seconds of free fall frightening you. I don't know. I guess dying in pain is a bad way to go, but like, I don't think you'd feel anything if you threw yourself off that cliff.
Yeah. And then hit your head on the rocks. Sure.
The 100G deceleration at the bottom would pretty much take care of all your consciousness, and all your bad teeth and anything else is wrong with you.
Speaking of bad teeth. Dude, there are two scenes in this movie that I can't bring myself to watch. You know, that I watch.
I know the scenes you're talking about.
Yeah. Through my fingers. It's that scene, the dentistry, the amateur survivor dentistry. And then the... they really know how to build the tension in that scene.
Yeah, they really do, man.
That one, and when he punctures his leg in the water with the coral, that's another one.
Oh, God. Yeah, and the blood just gashing out of him, man. Yeah,
it's brutal.
I actually thought that, when I was first seeing it, I thought that would be more of a thing, like him dealing with infection and whatnot, because, man, getting all that coral broken in there can't be good for you.
Especially when he takes the bandage or whatever off and they show
it. It's so gross. But I don't know. Gave him a pretty cool scar. It seems like seawater cures everything, because that was always his go-to. Like, my feet bleeding, seawater. Hands bleeding, seawater. Thigh bleeding, guess what? More seawater. Tooth hurting, pack some seaweed with, guess what? Soaked up seawater.
Saline, you use what you got.
I mean, that's true. That's the only medicine he's got, so he's got to do it for everything. I want to talk about, like... You know, this movie cost a lot of money. I don't even know where the money went to. I'm sure it's expensive to film on a remote location, and I know they actually did film a lot of this on a remote location. Mm-hmm. But also, there was like a really... Like, this disaster sequence is no joke. And it's so effective in storytelling, because we've just watched this Chuck guy go on these tangents about how time is important and you can't waste time. Don't make the sin of wasting time. He's trying to schedule every minute so he can savor every minute with his girlfriend, his fiance. And then in this disaster situation, I thought it was really poignant how the pilots pointedly say, hey, you need to get down and buckle in. And what does Chuck do but just piss away time for the next 2 minutes? Like, it's like, I was just thinking how ironic that was. Like, if he sits down right now and puts his fucking the pocket watch in his pocket and gets everything together, like, I don't know. Like, it's a cascade effect. Does he make it onto the island with the survival? Because that's the other thing. He's got the raft, but the survival kit doesn't make it on because it gets caught in the wreckage. It's a really frightening thing. Like, because I've, you know, as did you ever get the jump seat?
No, I never did.
Damn, because I thought it was really nostalgic. I actually got the jump seat on one of the big ones when I came back from Hawaii that I went to on FedEx's dime. But it's nice. A really cool thing. Like on the smaller plane, you just literally sit up in the cockpit with the captain. In the larger planes, they have like a row of like, you know, 4 to 6 seats that are kind of like they show in the picture. But I thought that was really nostalgic. And then the fact that, like, you know, when the locks broke on the I forget what they call those cargo containers started rolling. They had the big safety netting that's supposed to, like, you know, be the last ditch. And I'm like, there's no way that's going to hold when they hit the water. And the ship breaking up, the shipping, like, you know, you can see it kind of disappearing into the deep. All that stuff was horrific and just terrifying. Yeah. And then once he gets to the safety of the raft, you have the jet engine that almost sucks him in. I've forgotten how much of a production it was. I thought he kind of like blacked out, washed. But like those scenes on the high, that's the one thing. As much as I love sailing and stuff, like, I don't know what the fuck you do in even a well-provisioned boat, like a 30-foot yacht sailing through seas like that on a raft. Good. Get the fuck out of here. No. It's terrifying.
Yeah. No, you hope to drift to a deserted island, I guess. Or better yet, a civilized island.
Yeah. That's the other thing. Like, him just walking around, like, yelling at nobody for, like, the first 2 or 3 minutes, I thought was, you know, why he's still wearing his Christmas sweater was really effective.
Yeah, and there are a couple of, like, really, really impressive shots, I think. Impressively timed with dialogue and other stuff. One of them is when he first wakes up on this beach, and he's walking around, he's all disheveled, he's in shock, right? And he's just doing what he knows how to do, which is walk around and make sure the packages are delivered, pick them up off the beach. But the way that, like, he's walking toward the camera, and you can tell he spotted something on the beach, and you're not sure what it is. Is it civilization? Is it another person? Like, what is it? And then the way that they just, with the tide, just drift this FedEx package in. From the corner of the frame is so perfect. And there's another really amazing shot when he comes back and he's talking to Stan, played by Nick Searcy, about his suicide attempt, right? And the you know, calm that came over him and the idea of just, you know, getting by somehow. The way they frame that shot is Stan is hidden by Tom Hanks' face. It's shot in profile here. And he's talking about something. And as they're panning around, you're not sure who he's talking to. But eventually they pan far enough around that right as you realize what he's talking about, you also realize who he's talking to. And I think it's like this perfect coordination between the script, the actor, the cameraman, all of it just works in perfect concert there. It's a beautiful shot.
And it's almost like a 4 minute wonder too, where it's just the camera spinning around the Tom Hanks.
Yeah, and then when he gets to the darkest parts of it, you know, it's staring him dead in the face, right? It's like, that's a powerful scene.
And it reminds me, there's a couple scenes, like one of the first times I became aware of that is the first time I watched Godfather, because it opens on like this like 5 minute pull into some dude's face, like just how absorbing. Like a little bit of camera mode and like how much that can add to the storytelling itself, the camera work is because you're right. Yeah. Like now that I'm thinking about it beat for beat, it's like it's really well choreographed.
Oh, yeah.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the 4 pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
I thought there's a lot of other things that they did were like things that if you pick up on rewatch, like when he finds the assistant pilot or whatever the third in command was, and he says, not Alan, Albert, because he had realized he'd called him Alan a couple times without him correcting on the plane.
Yeah.
And it's another one of those subtle things where it's like they're telling you, you know, it's like he just heard, you know, his friend, you know, Nick Searcy talk about as well, realize I had no idea this guy was going through this. Am I even a good friend? And now he just realized that, like, oh my God, I didn't even know this guy. I fly this all the time and I didn't even know his name and this guy didn't even bother to correct me. I mean, like, there's a lot of like kind of I just love how they gave him all these moments. Like, they give him a lot of time to process the different, you know, like stages of like grief, like being in denial about like, well, help is going to come anytime, you know, bargaining. Well, if I do this and that, and I thought this was really cool. And, you know, him, I don't know, there's something really interesting about him burying the guy and having this service and then saying that's it. And just, you know, what do you do if what is the right way to pilfer a guy's body but also give him dignity? And
yeah,
you know, and the idea in the, like, survival situations, this is something that because it's something that I was like, you know, become aware of and is reading like a Sapiens book, but just like how much leisure time a person has if all you have to do is keep your dumb ass alive.
Sure.
And like a wilderness situation is reasonably abundant with resources. Like, it's not that much time. Hunting and gathering and building and sheltering and clothing. Like, there's so much more time for art and leisure. It's the bummer of it in his case is there's no one there to share it with.
Yeah.
But like,
and he's also bad at it. That Helen Hunt portrait is god awful.
It never really gets better. Like, no, they have a couple of where he's learned how to like grind up and make colors and stuff, and it's like, nope, it's still pretty bad. 4 years, you didn't get the 10,000 hours to perfect it. Mm-mm. But I thought that's like the realization of like, you just got oceans of time to occupy yourself if all you really have to do is worry about your daily caloric needs and making sure you're comfortable in not too, I guess this isn't a too extreme environment, tropical. You know, I'd like to see him do this in one of the Aleutian Islands. Is it Aleutian or Aloysian? I don't know how to. I just realized
I've
never
Aleutian.
Heard. Aleutian. I just realized I've never heard that island chain pronounced out loud. You think that's in all the years I watched Most Dangerous Catch, they never mentioned it.
Yeah, that's shocking. I will say that there's another good shot that I forgot about. As he's leaving the island on his raft. With, you know, the angel wings sail and Wilson strapped to it. He looks back at the island. There's a moment. There are two moments in this movie where he ventures out a little bit farther than he's comfortable with. The first time, you know, he's unable to get past the waves that are breaking, so he can't get out to the open ocean, and he washes back to the island. The second time, he manages to get out past it, and then he almost has this moment of regret. Reluctance, like, you know, he's on his way to safety, or he's headed down a path that is not as safe right as where he was before, and they say everything they need to say there with just Tom Hanks looking back at the island and then us seeing the reverse shot of the island. It says it all, right? Like, this, of course, this is a bad situation. He doesn't want to be stuck on an island, but he also survived on that island. That is also the only bit of safety left in his life. Yeah. Now he's leaving that.
There's that nifty shot where the island in the final, like, he doesn't, like, turn his back on it, like Lot's wife, you know, or whatever. It's just eaten by a shroud of mist and rain.
Yeah.
Which is why I think why the sailors, old-time sailors, used to be the most superstitious folk alive, because it is a fucking trip to see a whole island, like, disappear behind the fog bank or something come out of something. And I thought it's a really effective, like, this... Like, what, and I thought it was really emblematic of, like, what he must feel like post-rescue, you know? Like, there's a lot of really great scenes of him marveling at, like, look at this table full of food that's just going to go to waste. And look at, like, this Bic lighter. I can just hit a button and make fire, something that would take me a day to do. And I thought there's a lot of really good scenes of showing, like, the unreality of it. And the island disappearing, like... What do you do with that? This is 4 years of your life, you know? I wonder if it's like The Wire's view of the prison, like the only day, the first day and the last day are the only ones that are real to you.
Uh-huh.
Everything else was just, you know, these experiences.
I find it hilarious that they serve him sushi, which is raw fish, and crab legs, and he just tosses them down. He doesn't want anything to do with
it. Gotta love crab. Gotta love crab.
Yep.
A lot of that. Why? Okay, I got some questions.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think he spared the angel package?
I think that was a representation of his hope that he would get off the island. Like, it was the only significantly marked package. So yeah, he kept that around, and if he would have ever had to open that, that's sort of him giving up. But I don't know, because he never opens it, and he also does give up, right? He tries to kill himself.
He did the suicide test. Maybe he was going to do the test and then have like one final feast and then open up the package. And then, of course, there's also one of the funniest Super Bowl commercials of all time. It was like, I think the year or two after it came out, where he knocked on her and he's like, "So what? By the way, what was in that package?" He's like, "Oh, nothing much. Just a satellite phone, GPS, a receiver, survival, like, you know, a water desalinator, just silly stuff, you know."
Yeah.
But I thought it kind of muddies the movie a little bit for me, because the reason he makes it very clear, the reason that he wanted to survive and the reason he gave up hope was Helen Hunt.
For sure.
And they have this dual kind of like purpose of survival. Like, well, he had the large main emotional unit in Helen Hunt, but when that spun out, he had the reserve auxiliary hope system of the angel wings to keep him going, to give him purpose.
Yeah.
I felt like they kind of probably in a better, like, I don't even know why. It seems like an unforced error that, like, at some point in the writing process, they would have realized that they're literally having him straddle two different fences. And
he's got Wilson to represent a lot of that, too. So
right,
you don't necessarily need all three of those things. But
there might even been two sides of a pull, like the island, you know, the safety and security and the life that he's built, giving that up for the hope of the Helen Hunt and, like, having to let Wilson go to get her. But it's like a weird triangle love affair going on.
Yeah, the problem is they had the end of this movie, which needs that package to make sense, needs that package to show you that he's got this idea for what a future might look like at the end. You know, the end of this movie is him essentially like choosing to pursue this woman with the angel wings in some way, in some form. So you kind of need that package to still be there at the end, or, you know, you don't even need it to be there. You know, you could have him open it and him, you know, paint that on his cave wall or whatever, the wings, and then just have him remember the wings, because the audience is sure going to remember the wings at the end. You know, they had him painted on the sail. Like,
yeah,
you're right. You're right. They didn't need that package.
I don't even know they needed the woman at the end. Like, honestly, because I remember, I can't remember if we talked about this on the podcast already, but it was just in passing. Yeah. That, like, when I was 24 years old, I remember being very confused about how I was supposed to feel about, you know, because, like, all movie experience, like, it reminds me of the first time I watched Braveheart, and I realized, oh shit, and then movies, not the good guy doesn't win all the time. In fact, sometimes the good guy gets fucked royal, and you just have to deal with that after you're done with the movie. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Like, this is like, well, I just like, yeah, he's somehow she's going to have, like, you never gotten over him. And the idea that she's back with this guy, and there's a lot of like really weird mixed things, like the husband comes in and is like, you know what, Helen Hunt, she's just really distressed, you know. First she lost Bill Paxton, now she lost you. her tornado dissertation went up and you're thinking like, okay, well, this guy, she's like too distraught in the thing, and she sent him in there. But then like Tom Hanks observes and it seems like she wants to go in, and the husband's like, oh no, you don't want to do this. I'm like, well, I don't know how I fucking feel about that. And then she shows up. And now I guess as an adult, I just realized that this is just a really messy situation that is going to make no one happy. Like, there is nothing you can do or say as anyone in this that's a wrong answer. There's not a right answer. There's a whole bunch of stuff that's bummers for people all around. But I like the ambiguity. I like the fact that, like, what her friend, like, it's wild because I'm like, this must be a tough movie to watch if you're in the situation where a loved one of yours has disappeared and it's been a few years, because, you know, your friends and family say, hey, you need to let this guy go. He's dead. It's healthy to move on. But, you know, you just know in your heart that he isn't. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Like, the rational, the healthy decision is to move on, even in that ambiguity. But like, here's a movie where she's almost punished for it. You know, Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
You know, he carries it like a Buddhist monk. Like, he doesn't like put it on. Like, I think he does about as good a job as he can with like not burdening him with the, you know, hey, I'm not going to make me your problem. But I really, like I said, in almost like the sense of like a Leftovers episode, I really like that kind of just like melancholy. This sucks. And that's the way life is sometimes.
Exactly.
And then I feel like they fuck it up with the Texas lady.
They do. I feel like that's showing more like there is a future for this guy. You know, he's at a little crossroads and he can, you know, decide to pursue something here. And in this case, it's the woman with the angel wings, which, you know, plot wise, they needed that package just to get him there physically. But then whatever. I think the Helen Hunt stuff is maybe the most, you know, it's the second most engaging, but in a movie with not a lot of things that happen, it stands out as something that is powerful, because, man, this situation is so fucked up, especially once he shows back up. Like, yeah, there's all the grief and the confusion and the, you know, whatever, the uncertainty of him maybe still being out there. But once he shows up, there is no way out of this situation that doesn't result in some kind of regret. If she goes with the love of her life and makes a new life, she's abandoned this family that she built in the 5 years between him disappearing and showing back up. There's regret in that. If she doesn't go with this man and stays with her family, which that is the choice she makes, I think it's the better of the two bad choices. There's a ton of regret about what could have been with Tom Hanks. So, like, these are the kind of situations in life that do not provide easy answers, and the movie doesn't either, and I really appreciated that.
I really do. It's frustrating when I was younger, but now as old, it's like, man, that's really cool. And also, I'd love to see a cut where Mr. Big, that's the guy who this is, right? It's Sex in the City, Mr. Big. He's like,
I don't know,
looking out the front window at this, because like, she, you know, oh, my husband and my kids asleep in bed. That's before you started screaming, Chuck, Chuck. And he comes roaring up behind, and you have like, and he's just like, he's like, what the hell's going on out here? And he just sees you guys making out in the rain. He's like, my worst nightmare. You Chuck, you son of a bitch. You should have stayed on the island, Chuck. He's just like, yeah, just sitting there screaming in a glass box of emotion.
Yeah.
Cause that would be a hard thing to deal with, honestly.
For sure. And I don't really like how he plays it when, you know, they come to the FedEx office. I don't like that. He shouldn't need to, like, protect her from some perceived emotional trauma.
I can see a person doing that. I can definitely see a person doing that and even telling themselves it's the right decision to make. But, like, yeah, nah, you have to let that person needs to process a lot of things, and there's nothing you can do.
No. But yeah, it's a tough position for him too, for sure. It's weird.
What did you think about, like, I thought, because some of the stuff, like I said, in the denouement kind of didn't really work for me. I also didn't think, because one of the things I thought was interesting is when Tom Hanks' character Chuck realizes that he's kind of, you know, gone committed a boner with his buddy by not paying attention to his needs. And then he kind of like over like steps in their roles, like, you know, I've got some oncologist and some specialist, and, you know, you can make some phone calls. And like the guy, Nick, looks at him like, you know, what are you doing? Like, I appreciate you. Like, yeah, this is like too much, too late kind of in a thing. And then like Tom Hanks, like that's just, he just resumes like, hey, I'm sorry I wasn't there for you when Mary died. It's wild because I don't think that version of Chuck pre-Island would have followed through in any of the lessons he was beginning to learn in the first stage of Castaway. And it felt like a false character moment. Yeah.
It feels like a changed character moment to me. It's like he's not necessarily apologizing for the act of not being there for him when his wife was dying of cancer. He's apologizing for being the guy he was when that was happening. Yeah, I wonder and if that, he should have seen had, it, he should have been a better friend, that kind of thing.
I wonder if they could have had that conversation after the 360 rotating 4-minute oneer, where like at the end of that, he's like, you know, I thought a lot about the island, and I really was sorry that I couldn't be there for you for Mary or whatever, because like I said, it's a couple things. They weren't wrong. It just they didn't feel earned, or they didn't feel like, you know, what I don't know what would happen in quote unquote real life.
Gotcha.
But what
I will say, he's driving illegally in this movie. He comes back from the island. Man?
Yeah.
Well, no, surely his license has expired, right? He's been on the island 5 years. They're only valid 5 years,
right.
Unless the day before he went off to the island, he got his license renewed. He's probably driving illegally. Just
plus he's still a deceased person. I would have loved to seen him like get a traffic ticket. Like, what is like, okay, you're driving an expired license, but also you're not a legal entity to be charged. So at the time you committed to crime, you were dead. We're going to bring you back to life tomorrow. It'd have been an interesting kind of, I'd need to submit this to that Legal Eagle guy that does cinematic legal cases. Like, what would have happened if Chuck had gotten arrested for, you know, driving without a license on the night before he got brought back to life?
Castaway 2, it's basically like Double Jeopardy, except can you be charged with a crime if you're dead?
Yeah, Castaway 2, civil court. One other question I've got for you. Is this a Christmas movie?
It takes place on Christmas Eve. Or the beginning of this takes place on Christmas Eve, right?
Yes.
And like the day before, because I guess he's flying to Russia and back. So, I don't think this is a Christmas movie. I think this is.
I don't either.
A movie that features a little bit of Christmas decoration.
Right. Yeah. Like, there's a couple movies where, like, if there's a scene that's set in Christmas because it takes place over a long period of time, I don't think it automatically makes it a Christmas movie. The reason, like, that Die Hard is and this isn't is because Die Hard takes place entirely on Christmas. There's Christmas music being played.
It factors into the plot as well. This doesn't. This is just decoration.
Yeah, same with Lethal Weapon. Like, Lethal Weapon especially, like, there's several character moments that hinge on it being Christmas time. And, like, I can't kill myself because it's Christmas. Like, whereas this, like, literally the setup is Christmas. And that's it. That's it.
And he would have gone off to the island on another flight if it wasn't Christmas, right? It's not like, oh, it's Christmas and so the plane crashes.
They didn't
run into Santa's sleigh mid-flight or something.
Yeah. But I will say that maybe it's like half a Christmas movie or a 25% Christmas movie. So, like, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you want the fully leaded Christmas movies, go to Christmas.baldmove.com and be a club member or a patron, because that's where you get the no holds barred, unapologetic Christmas fucking movies. What else do we have to talk about?
I got one more thing that I didn't know. I don't know how I assumed that these things worked. I guess I assumed that life rafts inflated with some like rapid intake pump of some kind, like pulling air in very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, when he opens this underwater, what are they filling the raft with? Apparently these things have like CO2 canisters in them, just highly compressed CO2 that then rapidly, you know, just opens and rapidly fills the thing. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's cool. A lot of the next gen flotation rafts and personal flotation devices have moisture sensors. So when they get submerged in water, they instantly detonate and deploy, which is a plus if you're knocked unconscious, as people often are in a marine time disaster. So
not so great if you're in a rainstorm with a couple of packages of these things.
No. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I wonder about like how moist, because like, especially on a PFD, because I've seen them advertised in sailing, you know, like serious, like cross ocean sailing type competitions and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they cost like hundreds of dollars, not thousands of dollars. Like, you get wet all the fucking time in like a rough passage in the North Atlantic. Like, it's coming to sheet, the water's coming down in buckets. So there must be something that, like, it's not just like mist or moisture. It's like, right. No. This whole compartment is flooded internally, making a circuit, you know, setting off the charge, whatever. Cause I had the same question. Like, how does it tell the difference between just standing outside in a nor'easter and being 3 foot underwater, you know, like it's kind of a theoretical boundary there in some of those storms.
Yeah. So I want to talk real quick about the awards that this movie was nominated for and won, the Academy Awards. It was nominated for two awards, Best Actor for Tom Hanks and Best Sound, and it did not win either of them. It's interesting because, you know, it was nominated for Best Sound, which there's not a lot of sound in this movie, although it might have been nominated for the absence of sound to a large degree, because that's sort of defining of this movie, right? They even took out the creature noises that would have been present on an island like this further enhance the feeling of isolation. So you don't hear a lot of birds, you don't hear any like insects or anything. It's all just silence, waves, Tom Hanks, isolation. Mm-hmm. The other thing you don't hear a lot of is music. Do you think that they put a soundtrack out for this movie?
I don't know, because I looked up, because I had the same question. Like, Alan Silvestri scored 24 of the movie's 143 minutes of runtime, and that includes 7 minutes for the final credits.
The credits, yeah.
Okay, the final credits, not the credit scene. So that means, what, there's 17 minutes of score throughout the rest of the movie. One of them was like a Russian version of Jingle Bell Rock, which is not an original. This might be the lowest effort per pay movie score of all time.
It could be, yeah. Not a lot of music in this. I guess the only real song is that theme. Castaway theme for the end credits. They did put out a soundtrack for this, just if you're wondering.
Damn.
What did they fill it with, you ask?
Gilligan's Island outtakes?
Sure. What was it? It was Robert Zemeckis banging coconuts together the entire time.
While Tom Hanks was playing a reed, yeah.
I mean, essentially, it is selections from Robert Zemeckis and Alan Silvestri's former collaborations together. So think Back to the Future Part 2's end theme. Think
on Castaway?
Think What Lies Beneath's end credits. Think Who Framed Roger Rabbit's suite. There is one track on this entire 10-track album that is actually from this movie. It's the end credits. The rest of it is just Back to the Future music. Like, what the fuck?
That's weird, because I thought it'd be a fun album to do. Just like, imagine like an ASMR experience where it's just crashing sounds and like...
Yeah, they have those.
Like every 30 seconds a coconut drops, or maybe it's 30 it's 3 minutes of Tom Hanks scraping with the wood thing. Just
and then him just shouting, Wilson!
Yeah.
There's a whole track.
Yeah, like, because like, I think one of the reasons it got an Oscar for sound is the fact that like nothing on the island was usable in terms of sound. They had the Foley and ADR, literally everything, because the pounding surf was so loud. So that like all that stuff, when you hear him scraping with someone in a studio in Hollywood, is like trying to duplicate and ape that stuff, the rocks banging together.
Yeah.
So like that's kind of like, you know, if you have the ADR and Foley, 120 minutes of a film, that's and have it be seamless, like, yeah, that's exactly what it sounds like to be on a desert island in the Pacific. I could see that being it seems like the Oscars on the technical side love to do that kind of like, oh, why did this thing get makeup and costuming awards? It's because you didn't notice the costuming and makeup, huh? Must have been pretty fucking effective then. It's one of those kind of like huge amount of work that's not obvious. They kind of like to call that stuff out because it's impressive to them. You know, like, none of this was usable. You duplicated it all. Holy shit! Give him an Oscar.
Then it's amazing that the score didn't win because he did nothing. He did nothing. You didn't notice it? That's because it wasn't there. Oh, didn't look at that. Though?
Yeah. Didn't he, though?
And Russell Crowe and the Gladiator took home all the golds that year. It won Best Picture, it won Best Actor, all that stuff. So
that's a fine movie, but I wonder that this might be a sneaky year to go back and evaluate how we feel about that. Because, like, do you know what the other big movies were that year? Because, like, man, was Gladiator that good or was that just a weak year? Because Gladiator, I don't think, is like a once-in-a-decade film. It's good. It's entertaining. I like it.
I agree.
It's a pretty brainy action film, but...
And I don't know that the Russell Crowe performance is particularly stellar.
Did he get
stellar.
An Oscar for that?
He won it, yeah. Beating out Tom Hanks and Ed Harris for Pollock, which I didn't see. Jeffrey Rush on Quills. Javier Bardem. So the Best Picture category had Gladiator, which won. Then it had Chocolat. It had Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It had Aaron Brockovich and Traffic.
Huh. Yeah. That's like, yeah. None of those. Like, Traffic's pretty good, but...
Surprised this didn't get nominated for Best Picture, frankly. It's so different from anything else.
Came out right in the middle of Oscar season, too.
Yeah. Surprising.
I got a couple pieces of Tom Hanks trivia that I thought were fun that they worked into this film because, you know, him and Zemeckis go a long, long way back. They gave him bottles of Dr. Pepper on the return flight as per Forrest Gump's favorite drink in Forrest Gump. Hanks' first television role was Kip Wilson in Bosom Buddies back in 1980 and also married to wife Rita Wilson. Working in the Wilson theme there. And finally, in the movie You've Got Mail, he says to Annabelle and Matt, I know you, in exactly the same way he says it to Wilson when he's restoring his face. So there's a couple little fun Tom Hanks Easter eggs in this Tom Hanks vehicle I wouldn't have got, because I've never seen You've Seen Mail or You've Got Mail.
I did see it once, but...
Yeah. I vaguely remember Bosom Buddies. I can remember the theme song and a really young Tom, but I don't. Yeah. So like, I appreciate it. I appreciate the Easter eggs. Mm-hmm. And that's going to do it for Castaway. It's probably the last prestige movie of 2020. I've had quite the year of prestige movies and I expect to have quite the year next year, 2021. Perhaps theaters will be something again. Perhaps first-run movies will be. It sounds like we're going to get some first-run movies. Wonder Woman's coming out. On Warner Brothers is going to be coming out on HBO Max. Tenet's supposed to be coming out real soon, if it's not available already. Definitely think some things I'm interested in seeing. We get the first-run movies come back. But this is it for 2020, the 20th anniversary of Castaway. Thank you for listening to Bald Move Prestige this year. Really appreciate your guys' listenership and support, and hope to see you back in 2021 for some more great movies. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you next year.